Wolf. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg, South Africa. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Today is Tuesday, July 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, with COVID cases surging, U.S. President Donald Trump continues to push to reopen schools while accusing Democrats of playing politics.
I think they think they'll do better if they can keep the schools closed in the election. I don't think it's going to help them, frankly, but I think they feel that by keeping schools closed, that's a bad thing for the country, and therefore that's a good thing for them.
Political unrest continues in Mali as protesters vow to continue until the president there resigns.
Thousands of troops on the ground, but it's insecurity and mass killing of Mali innocent people in the center still happening.
And actress Kelly Preston has lost her battle with breast cancer. It's all on today's International Edition. Global coronavirus infections passed 13 million on Monday, marking another milestone in the spread of the disease, which has killed more than 500,000 people in 7 months. At a video news conference, World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the world is unlikely to get back to business as usual.
There will be no return to the old normal for the foreseeable future. But there is a roadmap to a situation where we can control the disease and get on with our lives.
The first case was reported in China in early January, and it took 3 months to reach 1 million cases. It has taken just 5 days to climb to 13 million cases from 12 million recorded on July 8th. Tedros is urging world leaders to provide more clear and consistent strategies.
The only aim of the virus is to find people to infect. Mixed messages from leaders are undermining the most critical ingredient of any response.
The coronavirus resurgence in the U.S. is sparking new debate over whether schools should reopen in the fall. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
President Trump says there's only one answer.
We have to open the schools. We have to get them open.
Again, arguing those who say schools cannot safely reopen are just trying to hurt him politically. California's two biggest school districts, Los Angeles and San Diego, say kids will not return to classrooms next month, but will keep learning at home. As the debate here continues, the World Health Organization's chief warns there will be no return to normal life anytime soon. And if more countries do not adopt comprehensive plans to fight the virus,
it's going to get worse and worse and worse.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The 27 European Union foreign ministers met Monday for the first time in person since the pandemic began. While many expected the coronavirus and issues of Africa to be top of mind, the leaders were actually focused heavily on China's new security law in Hong Kong, which Josep Borrell, EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, described as very draconian.
Our message in this context is twofold. First, to the people in Hong Kong, the support of the European Union for their autonomy and fundamental freedom. We will continue to stand by the people of Hong Kong. And to China, the message is that the recent actions change the rules. This will require revision of our approach and will clearly have an impact on our relations.
Reporter Catherine Field has been covering the meetings and joins us now from Paris with details. Catherine, it would appear that China will be high on the agenda at the EU summit later this week, and apparently issues regarding Turkey, also another one of the bloc's major items on the agenda.
There had earlier been very strong words from the European Commission president warning of very negative consequences for Beijing because of this new national security law that has been brought in Hong Kong. Unfortunately, there were no actual measures taken or agreed upon. There were very strong words, though, and among the proposals that is now going to be put forward, there will be possibility of an export ban on sensitive technology to Hong Kong. There will also be a question of a ban on the sale of armed weapons to Hong Kong police. There's also going to be a possibility of reviewing the extradition agreements with Hong Kong authorities. That is because there is real concern that any extradition back to Hong Kong would mean or could risk that this person would actually be transferred to mainland China, where it is widely held that courts are controlled by the ruling Chinese Communist Party. Several of the countries are very positive on these measures, particularly France, Germany, Denmark and the Netherlands. But there are other partners in Europe, such as Hungary and Greece, that are resisting this because they have very close trade ties with China.
Hmm. Well, they also had a lot of issues with Turkey, a long laundry list. What specifically were some of their main points of contention?
The relations between the EU and Turkey have really been deteriorating for sort of the last 4 years. And as there's been a more widespread crackdown on political opponents in Turkey, so the relations have soured even more. In particular, at the moment, the European Union is concerned particularly about energy exploration off Cyprus. Cyprus, of course, is an EU member and has come to the EU hoping for some very tough language, but it failed to get it as well today. I mean, this key partner for the EU, Turkey, doesn't, according to the EU foreign policy chief, fully respect EU values and principles. But nevertheless, it was more talk about dialogue, about downing the tensions, not stoking tensions any further, but nothing actually concrete. Again, another issue which the European Union is concerned about, it's the plan to reconvert Istanbul's Hagia Sophia monument into a mosque. The European Union feels that this will stroke religious tensions. And again, they're calling on the Turkish authorities to reconsider, reverse this decision. Another area where the EU is very concerned is in Libya. It feels that the Libyans should be allowed to sort out their own problems without Turkish interference. It is alleged that Turkey is delivering arms to Libya and that should stop. That's in violation of agreements. However, underpinning all this, one has to remember that the EU is absolutely terrified that there could be a return to that 2016-2015 influx of migrants which came across from Turkey into Europe. And that is what the EU is worried about, that if it upsets Turkey, then Turkey will renege on that agreement to stop the flow of refugees into Europe. So that is what is underpinning all this dialogue that's going on at the moment and this stepping back from imposing any type of sanctions, trade restrictions on Turkey, a country which, again, as the EU representative said, is not respecting EU values.
Reporter Catherine Field in Paris. Mali's opposition continues to reject concessions by President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita aimed at resolving an escalating political crisis that has sparked deadly protests, saying it would be satisfied only if he resigns. Police in Mali's capital, Bamako, fired into the air Monday to disperse protesters just hours after the United Nations condemned the use of lethal force against demonstrators. The clashes came after a chaotic few days in Bamako, beginning on Friday, when demonstrators occupied state buildings and police opened fire. The area is a hotbed of a month-long protest movement denouncing Keita's failure to quash militia violence or address disputed legislative election results. Joining us now from the capital is VOA French to Africa Service multimedia producer Chico Tiro. Thank you so much for being with us. What's the current situation there on the ground?
Right now, the situation in Mali, in Bamako, is very tight right now between the police and the protester and resistance, protesters resisting. And they have been to places when they burned the president political party, Siège and Trois Logements. And Bamako was attacked and they open up and they throw stuff outside of the street and burn it. So the situation right now on the ground is very scary. Things are escalating from every aspect of security in the town right now. And the protesters don't want to listen to the president or to the authority in there.
Has the country slid into the type of chaos that would make it virtually impossible for the current president to stay in office? Or ultimately, what happens if
he were to step down, could it create even further instability?
Yes, the country have slid into a chaos that will make it almost impossible for this president to stay in the office, but he cannot leave in this condition because of the country is very, people are divided right now. A lot of people stand up against this president's plans of overcoming the situation on the crisis, the insecurity crisis, and the killings of innocent people every few weeks, and the mass killing of Mali military in the center of Mali. And this really make the population think like, or the president staying in the power doesn't benefit like the Mali people. And they think like he failed to have any plans to overcome this crisis about education, famine, and security, and health, and every aspect that you talk about it. And also they mentioned the insecurity and also the corruption. They mentioned how they find out about a lot of corruption in the government. It's been so, several names have been given them to know about the corruption in Mali. And they also attacked the president's son's house and yesterday, and they break into it and they stole stuff, they bring stuff out.
The president has said he will make the changes requested, but the opposition is now saying they just want him to resign. Why are they unwilling to negotiate? Is it a matter of trust that he won't follow through?
Ultimately, if this president steps down, I think things will dramatically escalate in the center, because this will be a chance for the terrorists to gain ground from the center to the south of Mali. And while they're figuring out everything with this in Bamako, the situation that's distracting people in Mali between the government and the opposition, and this will be a time for the terrorists to gain more ground in Mali. And if the president resigns, it will not be any specific strategy right now to overcome this thing that's going on with the terrorists and all this crisis. It could clearly create uncertainty because nobody knows what will happen. And as today we're talking right now, they have said that the opposition leader Soumaila Cissé have been killed, but the news is not confirmed yet. But it was so on so many news that the Soumaila Cissé body have been found dead in Tombouctou Niafunke. And right now the call for the Soumaila Cissé political party and the people around him are investigating, and the government also, I believe they are, everybody's investigating if this is some true. And if this is true, it could be a strategy for terrorists to really let the people know that stepping into the chaos and take advantage of the situation that's going on in the capital, in the Bamako right now, and to put more fire to the people that are standing up against the government right now.
What sorts of real change does the opposition want?
The president said he will make the change requested, but the opposition now saying they want him to resign, because when the president said he will make changes, well, the first time they sit down with the president, they told him what they want the president to do. They wanted the constitutional court to resign because they have tricked some legislation, election victory to people. They want to redo that election, and they also want all those people to resign, and they also want to go with a new government. And the president came out firmly and tell them that he's going to keep the prime minister Boubou Cisse, which the opposition was waiting that he's going to change the government. And I don't know if they really felt like they wanted to get some position in the government they didn't get. After that talk, they haven't felt like the president meet any requirement they have done talk to him behind the closed door between them, which is why the protest still continuing, and because the president move on to do what he think is the best on his knowledge as a president of Mali. So this is really something that really escalated the protester, because they still think like this president have enough time to have a strategy and plans to overcome the insecurity in Mali. And they also believe nobody will help Mali get over this insecurity and fighting the terrorists better than Mali itself. And they also mentioned how come is a lot of military from all over the place, so Barkhane and French forces and UN forces all on the ground, thousands of troops on the ground, but it's insecurity and mass killing of Mali innocent people in the center still happening, killings of Mali population, which is why the opposition party doesn't have any trust on this administration and this government ahead of them. And the movement keep getting bigger and people start getting more involved, and people are divided in Mali.
That was Jack Diro, multimedia producer in VOA's French to Africa service. Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA.
Taliban militants clashed with security forces following a car bomb blast at a government compound in northern Afghanistan Monday, killing 10 people and wounding dozens more. The attack took place at a government facility close to an office of the National Security Directorate. About 60 U.S. universities Sunday filed a brief supporting a lawsuit by two others seeking to block a Trump administration rule barring foreign students from remaining in the country if educational institutions don't hold in-person classes this fall. The lawsuit was filed by Harvard University and Massachusetts Institute of Technology Wednesday in a federal court in Boston. Find more on these stories and much more at voanews.com. Washington's National Football League franchise has announced it's dropping the Redskins name after 87 years, AP correspondent Mike Hempen reports.
The team says it's retiring its nickname and the Indian head logo immediately, bowing to decades of criticism that they offend Native Americans. A new name will be selected, but it's not known how long that will take. The move comes less than 2 weeks after owner Dan Snyder, who once declared he would never change the name, launched a thorough review amid pressure from sponsors. FedEx, Nike, Pepsi, and Bank of America all lined up against the name, which was given to the team in 1933 when it was still based in Boston. Mike Hempen, Washington.
A U.S. Supreme Court ruling last Thursday seems in line with evolving attitudes across America and, in fact, the world. In the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement has sparked a growing consensus about racial equality for Black and brown people, as well as Native Americans, their land and culture. The high court last week recognized about half of the state of Oklahoma as Native American reservation land and overturned a tribe member's rape conviction because the location where the crime was committed should have been considered outside the reach of state criminal law. The decision means much of the eastern part of Oklahoma is legally considered reservation land, where more than 1.8 million people live, and that includes roughly 400,000 in Tulsa, the state's second largest city. Joining us to understand the significance of the Supreme Court's ruling is Nell Newton, professor of law at Notre Dame Law School and a former dean, as well as an expert on federal Indian law. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you first just explain this case to us and who filed it?
Jim C. McGirt is the person who took this to the Supreme Court, and he appealed a conviction he received in state court for a horrible crime, a sex crime against a minor child, for which he was serving 1,000 years in prison. His argument was not anything to do with not having done the crime. Everyone agrees, it looks as if he did, but that the Oklahoma courts, the state courts, did not have jurisdiction over him, the power to try him for this crime. That Mr. McGirt argued that federal Indian law, the body of law that should apply to him, provided that only federal courts had jurisdiction over major crimes committed on Indian reservations. So that's the argument that took him all the way to the Supreme Court. Under the U.S. system, the rule is going all the way back to the first Supreme Court. Indian tribes had a certain amount of self-government power before the U.S. took over, and therefore they are treated as being governments. And under this law also, by treaties and even by statutes, the Congress can take away property rights and governance rights from tribes. So the narrow issue here was, had Congress done that? Is there still, for instance, a reservation for the Creek Nation, of which Mr. McGirt was a member, in Oklahoma? Or had that reservation disappeared, either because Congress passed a statute redrawing the lines of the reservation or abolishing the reservation, or, as Oklahoma argued, because everybody just figured that it had disappeared and so they acted as if it had disappeared? If there is a reservation, then Mr. McGirt has to be tried under federal law in a federal court, so he would get a new trial. If there is no reservation, then the state can conviction stands. The Supreme Court held there is still a reservation in Oklahoma for the Creek Nation, and it's a rather large one and even encompasses parts of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
It's interesting because it seemed like there was a larger issue regarding Native American land.
I think the idea was there's a larger issue in that there are four other tribes who are similarly situated. Together, they probably own 47% of Oklahoma. And therefore, oh my God, chaos will follow. And who knows what will happen? These tribes will start pushing around all the non-Indians who live there. The state will lose all this tax money. All these previous convictions of jails will open, and all these people will you know, get sprung from jail. But actually, in the first place, Justice Gorsuch is a textualist. He wrote the opinion for the court, and he says text matters. Congress has the power to take it all away if they want to. Maybe it's morally wrong, but it's constitutionally permissible. They didn't do it. And the court shouldn't act for Congress when Congress hasn't acted. Moreover, this case deals with criminal law involving Indians on Indian reservations and not non-Indians. So there's still a lot of jurisdiction. And as to taxation and all these other parade of horribles, the Creek Nation and the other tribes in Oklahoma have a history of entering into hundreds of agreements with the state to share jurisdiction.
Well, I would imagine the Native Americans were pleased that it's acknowledging what is theirs and some of their rights.
Yes, especially because Justice Gorsuch's opinion is a classic textualist opinion. We associate that with conservatives. The text matters. We have to follow the text of a congressional statute. We can't just make things up. And many of us for years have thought, well, if that's the conservative's position, why has the Supreme Court been so activist in Indian law, creating all sorts of exceptions to tribal self-government that have not been created clearly by Congress? So this is very interesting because in writing this beautiful opinion, Justice Gorsuch makes clear that we have to follow the text. The text matters. If Congress wants to do more, it can do more. And he goes over some of these older cases and says, you know, the court's been reading them too broadly. We shouldn't look at what happens after a statute is enacted, because one of Oklahoma's big arguments was, well, all these white people moved in and everybody just assumed the tribes didn't have any authority anymore. Well, that's not a constitutional rule.
Do you think this will set in motion more cases for Native Americans to reclaim some of their, whether it's property or legal rights regarding criminality?
I think that some of these early cases about did Congress intend to redraw the lines of a reservation or eliminate a reservation, there will be some cases that tribes bring saying our statutes are similar. The other tribes in Oklahoma will no doubt act on this. Therefore, we still have our reservations as well. And I think for American Indians who've just been dumped on in so many different ways in the past, to read sort of beautiful language saying Congress made a promise, promises ought to be kept. I think the emotional impact is very strong.
Would you say the ruling was a happy occasion for Native Americans?
Yes, the ruling was a very happy occasion for Native Americans. And reading that opinion in which the justice so eloquently talks about the importance of keeping promises, I think hit people on a very emotional level. Finally, a court that as long ago as, or not so long ago as the 1950s, there's an opinion which the court calls Indian tribal members savages, that the court hears them, knows they're here, and shows respect for them.
Nell Newton, professor of law at Notre Dame Law School and an expert on federal Indian law. You're listening to International Edition. Stay with us. We'll be back in a minute.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can the AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London. Twitter at Border Crossings or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Today's annual Bastille Day in France will be very different this year, with the coronavirus pandemic shaping much more subdued celebrations and a new concept of war. Lisa Bryant has more on the festivities from Paris.
France's yearly display of military might is still on the menu, from jets and helicopters flying over Paris to troops on the ground. But most French will have to switch on their TVs if they want to see it this year. The traditional firemen's balls are canceled. And while Paris fireworks are still on, Mayor Anne Hidalgo recommends city residents watch them from home. Across France, Bastille Day 2020 is a toned-down affair. Just a few thousand will attend the main ceremony in the French capital, taking place at the Place de la Concorde instead of the hordes watching the usual parade down the Champs-Élysées. And this year, the nation pays tribute to healthcare and other frontline workers involved in a new battle, not in Mali or Afghanistan, but at home against COVID-19. Some of them are attending the Paris parade. So are health ministers from four European countries, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and Luxembourg, which took in French coronavirus patients.
Nous sommes en guerre.
All of this reflects the thinking of French President Emmanuel Macron. He has repeatedly described the fight against the pandemic a war. In recent weeks, France, which once had one of the world's highest coronavirus caseloads, appeared to be winning it. Daily cases have fallen sharply from several months ago, along with mortalities. But with lockdown a distant memory, health experts now fear a resurgence. The French are shedding their masks, heading to holidays, and increasingly greeting each other with the traditional double-cheek kiss. The numbers of sick are inching back up. Worrying traces of the virus have been found in Paris wastewater.
Les Français constatent un certain relâchement dans la distanciation sociale. On le voit avec des scènes qui
Today, the government is considering making mask wearing obligatory in indoor spaces. On France Info Radio, Health Minister Olivier Véran warned against relaxing social distancing guidelines. Along with Bastille Day, another French tradition promises to be observed. Some healthcare workers are planning to protest in Paris against recently agreed hospital reforms, which they argue do not go far enough. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Actor John Travolta announced Sunday on Instagram that his wife of 28 years, American actress Kelly Preston, has died at the age of 57. Preston has appeared in films including Jerry Maguire and Twins. Travolta's post said, "It is with a very heavy heart that I inform you that my beautiful wife Kelly has lost her two-year battle with breast cancer."
If I die young, bury me in satin, lay me down on a bed of roses, sink me in the
river. And Glee star Naya Rivera has been found dead at a Southern California lake, 5 days after Rivera's four-year-old son was found alone in a boat. Authorities say the boy told investigators his mother helped him get back aboard before he looked back and saw her go under. She's the third star of the Fox musical comedy series Glee to die in their 30s. Naya Rivera was 33. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us, and have a wonderful day.
If I die young, bury me in satin, lay me down on a bed of roses, sink me in the river at dawn, send me away with
time is green.